Welcome back to the show. Today we have a Q&A episode. Thank you to everybody who asked a question. We are going to do as many of these as we can in the next 37 minutes. I have a call at 10 o'clock, so we'll go right up until the bell there. This was an anonymous Q&A, so you already know that the first three questions were, are you straight? I have a crush on you, and is there anyone you miss right now? So obviously those are all Jenna, minus the straight one, and yeah, let's get into some real questions, which I'm sure there are plenty of. Cool. Next question. Habits that you would work with a person that doesn't want to do tracking or is afraid of tracking. Thanks. Yeah, I think the habits are the same, whether you track or not. When we're talking about, it depends on your goals, by the way, if it's weight loss, if it's, you know, just improving overall health, if it's performance, if it's muscle gain, whatever, there's a ton of overlap there. But whether you track or not, these are the same. And yes, there are certain portion size habits and strategies that you might want to use if you're not tracking and your goal is weight loss, for example, or even just weight maintenance. But just like overall lifestyle habits, they're the same. And I'm making this point because I think a lot of people think it's tracking or habits, tracking or lifestyle stuff. It's and. If you're going to track, it's and. If you're not going to track, obviously, it's just the lifestyle habit stuff. Going for more walks, whether that's counting your steps or not, but being more active, lifting weights, eating more fiber, eating more protein, you know, basic meal composition templates, like starting each meal with a protein and a plant, right? Identifying how much, you know, let's say 2/3 of your plate should be protein and plants. 1/3 of your plate can be kind of whatever rounds out that meal really well. I think that's a really great place to go. Talking about alcohol. I mean, all of these basic lifestyle habits should be happening whether you're tracking or not. It's not or. So yeah, habits that you would work on with a person that doesn't want to do tracking. I would work a lot on basic meal composition, eating more fiber, eating more protein, drinking more water, going for more walks, incorporating some weightlifting, working on sleep hygiene. Those would all be the big ones. The irony is that all of those things are important for overall health independently, and they will also make tracking easier. And so they do work kind of hand in hand there, even if you're not tracking, which you totally don't have to. Next question. Can you explain cable placement, higher or lower, and how it makes the exercise either harder or easier? For example, lateral raises or biceps. And so, yeah, obviously this is better discussed with like images and stuff, but when you're doing a dumbbell lateral raise, I'll try and explain this as if you're not looking at YouTube. When you're doing a dumbbell lateral raise, because you're using dumbbells, the line of force is always gravity, which means it's always straight down to the floor. And when your arm is at 90 degrees off your torso, basically pointed horizontally out, that's when the dumbbell is furthest away from you. And your arm, the limb that's moving the weight, and the line of force, gravity, make a 90-degree angle, right? Your arm is horizontal, gravity is vertical. They make a 90-degree angle. And so a dumbbell lateral raise is always going to be hardest when your arm is, you know, horizontal at 90 degrees of abduction, whatever you want to say, is directly pointed out, kind of parallel with the floor. When you use cables, you can shift what the line of force is. It is not straight up and down. It's on whatever angle that the cable is. And whenever the cable and your arm, right, just like gravity in your arm, when the cable and your arm make a 90-degree angle, that's where there is the most tension on the muscle. And so if you set up the cable at roughly wrist height when your arm is down at your side, then it's at roughly that point where there will be the most tension. Where the cable and your arm make a 90-degree angle, that's where there's the most tension. If you take a form video, it's really easy to see this. As the cable and your arm move into the same line, as you raise your arm up and up and up, and eventually the cable hits you in the arm, that's where there is basically no tension or very little tension. And so where the cable and your arm make a 90-degree angle, that's where there's the most tension when it comes to something like a lateral raise or a bicep curl. And when the cable and your arm are in the same line or they are touching, that's where there's the least tension. And so, yeah, the higher you bring the cable up until you get to about wrist height or hand height, makes the exercise harder in a more lengthened position, makes the exercise harder when your arm is closer to your side, more towards the bottom, more towards the earlier portion of a lateral raise or a bicep curl. That doesn't mean you always do that. It doesn't mean you only, you know, kind of modify things to make it harder in the length of position. There are so many different reasons and contexts to consider. But yeah, I think, you know, well, obviously training muscles in a length position is a good thing. And so we're not going to go into all the different contexts into when and why you might do that. But I want you guys to, if you're listening to this, watch your next form video of a cable lateral raise and see where the cable in your arm make a 90 degree angle. That's where it is hardest. The more you can make that towards the beginning of the lift, the part where your arms are down for a lateral raise, the more stretched the delts are. So you'll be challenging the muscle in a more lengthened position. That's a whole lot easier with some graphics and some images. And I did try and do some of it if you're watching on YouTube, just with my arms. But yeah, maybe that can be helpful. Next question. Have you ever discussed the whole metabolism is damaged and that's why you're not losing weight concept with a nutritionist? If not, would you be willing to have one on your podcast? Yes, I have. First of all, I'm a nutritionist, for whatever that's worth. And what you're talking about is like starvation mode. I'll be honest with you. Like there's, this is like you, this is kind of like, the earth is flat. It's like, why haven't I had, you know, an astrophysicist to come on and tell me why the earth is round? It's like, well, we just know this. Like, this would be a waste of a podcast. This is not like a, contested, idea by people who actually study this stuff and do it for a living. Like if someone's telling you your metabolism is damaged and that's why you're not losing weight and you need a reverse diet, they are just not up to date on human metabolism and the research that we have on reverse dieting and metabolic adaptation as a whole. They're just not up to date on what we currently know. And what the weight of the evidence tells us. One, I'm a nutritionist, hashtag defensive. And two, this isn't a concept that is really up for debate. And I've discussed it a million times on the podcast. If you're interested in this topic of metabolic adaptation and starvation mode and reverse dieting, I have a podcast with Eric Trexler, from whom I have derived a lot of my feelings on this topic. And so I would go back and search for that episode. God, it's definitely after episode 100. It's definitely in the 100s to 200s. It might even be in the 150s to 200s. That would be the episode I'd go back and listen to. But frankly, this is a waste of time. I'm not trying to shit on your question. I'm just saying like this isn't a concept that's actually like up for debate at all. All right. Next question. I'm just starting out running and after my longer runs, my hips are so sore. How come? Will this get better with time or would I benefit from training hip flexors directly? You would definitely benefit from training hip flexors directly, but that's more of like an obviously sort of answer. Like it's always a good idea to do that as a runner, is to have some hip flexor work in your program. Doesn't mean you need to always have it, but if you're asking me, hey, is that a good idea for runners? Yeah, totally. The biggest mistake people make with running and the biggest reason people get injured is they just do too much too fast. You're looking at this in a very acute, very granular level. You're saying, I'm running and my hips are hurting. And that means I need to strengthen my hips. When in reality, you got to take a step back and say, you might just be doing too much too fast. If you're like, will this get better with time? It would get better with time if you were doing this very gradually, like meeting yourself where you're at, increasing volume and intensity gradually. If you just, you know, kind of get off the couch and start running a few times a week and all of a sudden things are hurting, that's not going to get better if you just keep doing what you're doing. Your body's giving you feedback that you're doing more than you can recover from right now, and you probably ramped up volume and or intensity too quickly. And so I'm a big advocate of having alternate modalities to gain fitness as you start to incorporate running. And what I mean is, let's say you're like, oh, I want to start working on my cardio. I like running. I want to run. And you start running three times a week. I'm not saying categorically 100% will get injured, but that isn't what I would recommend if you were interested in trying to give yourself the least chance of getting injured. What I would do is I'd say, hey, why don't we start with a little walk run once a week? The other 2 days a week, I want you to get on a bike. And on the bike, we will work on kind of, let's say, general cardiovascular adaptations. And when we run, we will obviously also be working on cardiovascular adaptations, but we'll be work on specifically building up tolerance to running, because running does have a large eccentric component, does have a large kind of impact component that we need to think of. And so I would actually run once a week, do a bike twice a week, for example. Even now, when I did this with a coach, very gradually increased volume, I run 3 times a week. I bike 2 or 3 times a week. I'm still not at a point, and I don't think ever would be at a point where I would only run for this exact reason. I think that splitting that up into more than one modality that has basically no impact, and the other one being your kind of obligate modality, the modality you want to specifically get better at, is the way I would go with this. Next question. Currently in a 30 to 35% deficit, and I'm consistently losing 1 to 1.5 pounds per week. Do I need to take a diet break for physiological reasons, or can I just continue dieting? I'm assuming biofeedback continues to be good. I've been dieting for 6 weeks and would like to diet to 10 to 12 more and get it over with. Got you. So I have a, it's funny, I have a post coming out in the next, I don't know, maybe 5 to 10 days about a recent meta-analysis that looked at 12 studies with diet breaking and refeeds versus continuous energy restriction. Basically, groups that took breaks versus groups that didn't take breaks. Was there a benefit in terms of fat loss? Was there a benefit in terms of muscle gain? And was there a benefit in terms of metabolic rate or metabolic reduction? The long story short is there was no difference in body composition. So physiologically, from a muscle gain or fat loss perspective, you don't need to take a break. They did see, however, that the groups that took breaks saw that their metabolism reduced by less. So there was an advantage to taking diet breaks from a metabolism perspective. However, there's a huge caveat here, is that, I'll tell you now, I think this doesn't actually pan out in reality. They, when they took, let's say, BMR measurements of the group that was continuous energy restriction, the diet, so the groups that were not taking breaks, they took those measurements when people were in a deficit. When you're in a deficit, you will be, you will have some metabolic adaptation and you will, let's say, score lower on BMR. You will have a lower or a slightly reduced, temporarily reduced BMR. What you, what they should have done was had a period of weight stability and then tested BMR in that group, right? So basically what happened was the group that did not take breaks, when they went to test their BMR, these people were still in a deficit. So they had some temporary, some acute metabolic adaptation, and their metabolism looked like it was more reduced, or, you know, I guess technically was more reduced than the groups that were taking breaks. However, the groups that were taking breaks got their BMR measured after a break, after a period of eating more. Like, no shit that their metabolism was higher. We have other research that shows when you take BMR measurements after a period of weight stability, there is no difference in metabolic rate. So yeah, the answer is there's no physiological reason whatsoever that you need to take breaks. That doesn't mean you shouldn't take breaks. I think psychologically, taking a large goal and breaking it up into smaller chunks can be, might be, for some people, a way to make them overall more successful. Again, I want to repeat that, and I'm not going to go too deep into it right now, but you asked the question, do I need to take a diet break for physiological reasons, or can I just continue dieting? The answer is no, you don't need to take a break for physiological reasons. Yes, you can just continue dieting if the juice is worth the squeeze, if the biofeedback is worth the progress, if what you're getting out of it is worth what you're putting into it. There's no physiological reason you need to take a break. If someone's telling you you need to take a break so you don't damage your metabolism, or you're going to slow down your metabolism too much, or so that you don't lose muscle, or that's just made up. It's just not true. You diet so long as it's worth it. You break up the diet if doing so practically, logistically, psychologically will make you more adherent, more consistent, maybe more optimistic, maybe more positive, more able to digest the long-term goal that you have ahead. Great question, by the way. Thank you for all that context. Next question. Are there any people or accounts you recommend / don't recommend for women's health, especially in regards to perimenopause and menopause? Glad people are trying to bring it into the light, but that also comes with a lot of others spreading misinformation. I'm not going to specifically today call out accounts that I think I would avoid, although I see the merit in that. I would follow Dr. Jen Gunther. She would be somebody that I would immediately follow for good information on this, and she will share a lot of other accounts that I think do a good job on this. That would be my go-to source. She has a good book, which is almost an oxymoron in the nutrition and fitness space, having a good book that's actually up to date on with quality information. So Dr. Jen Gunther is who? Gunther or Gunther? Jesus Christ. I'm going to check right now. Jen Gunter. Yeah, that's what I thought it was. I said Gunther the first time? Yeah. Yeah, she's an OB. She's a bookseller, Jesus Christ, an author, and somebody that I highly respect and really appreciate her take on things. Also, Amanda Thebe is really great. I've had her on the podcast. She's wonderful. She wrote the book Menopocalypse. Really, really awesome. Just a wealth of knowledge on this topic as well. Beautiful. Next question. Have you heard of people taking colostrum? If so, do you know if there's any benefits? Yeah, I've gotten a couple questions on this, on the colostrum, and I've done... So if you're interested in a supplement, I would go to examine.com. And frankly, if you're really interested in this stuff, I would sign up for examine.com. Just they do a really good job consolidating the research and giving kind of a consensus on what the research says. Like, what does the weight of the evidence say? And it breaks down all the studies and just like there's a really good kind of database for you to kind of access this sort of a question, this sort of information. I have not seen anything that would make me recommend colostrum for any reason. So I have not been convinced of anything or any reason that people need to be taking colostrum. I really don't even know where this came from. So I have heard of it. I don't know that there are, as of right now, not convinced that there's any reason to be actively taking colostrum. That could change. And if it does change, I will let you know. Next question. So much zone two cardio talk lately. How important is it to focus on being in zone two? Not that much. Rather than just focusing on being active and going for a run slash bike ride and not worrying about what zone I'm in. I think you're really, really on the ball here. But most likely being above zone two. So basically, all this talk about zone two, how much do you need to worry about whether or not you slip into zone three, you went a little too hard, or it's a little zone one, you're going a little too easy? The answer is, for the average person, even for somebody who like is, when I say average person, I mean somebody just focused on health, not worried at all about performance. But honestly, I'm somebody who's worried a little bit about performance. And even I would say that I wouldn't worry so much about this. So a couple concepts, I could do a whole rant on this. I already see it coming. But the more you do, the more of something you do, the more you have to pay attention to how intense you are doing that thing. And what I mean is, like, if you train one time per week, let's say you do one lifting session per week, am I worried that if you take all those sets to the house that you're going to overtrain? I'm not, because it's only once per week. You're not doing it that much, so I'm not worried about you overdoing it. Now, if you're training six times per week with weights, you know, if you take all those sets to the house or you leave a rep or two in the tank across 6 days, that's a big difference in fatigue. And so if you're training a lot, then I'm more concerned with the intensity level, right? I'm more concerned with the possibility of you overdoing it, because if you overdo it a little bit across many days, that can really add up. If you're the average person doing, you know, 1 to 3 cardio sessions per week, 1 to 3 lifting sessions per week, I'm really not too worried about it. And I would say in general, because I don't have all that context from you, the question asker, is I'm not worried about this basically at all. If you're the average person trying to get healthy and you have a zone 2 day prescribed by me and you happen to split that in zone two and zone three, you're going to be fine. I'm really not worried about it. There's a lot of people are worried about slipping out of zone two. What happens is you start to burn more carbohydrates and you stop burning fat and it's not a big deal. You start producing lactase And so, lactate. Oh my God, my brain just fried. Lactate. And then you have to wait for that lactate to clear before fat oxidation comes. I wouldn't worry about that stuff at all. Seriously. If you're doing just like a moderate amount of cardio work and you don't really want to stress exactly being hyper specific with the heart rate or the zones, you do not have to. If you're like, hey, I'd rather just go for a bike ride. Like when you hear zone two, what you should think is this shouldn't be that difficult. Like I care more about session RPE. When I say zone two, yeah, technically zone two means steady state and not that hard. But you know, maybe you have hills in your neighborhood and, you know, you're not just going to get this nice, flat, steady state heart rate the whole time because there's going to be some incline, some decline. I'm not worried about it at all. I don't want to just be the it doesn't matter guy, because for some people, myself included, I'm doing five or six cardio sessions a week. So, and I'm lifting three times. I'm doing 9 workouts a week right now. if all of them are 10% harder than they're supposed to be, I might not recover well. But if you're doing, you know, three cardio sessions a week and you know, two of them are zone two and your heart rate was supposed to be, you know, your coach is like, hey, 60 to 70% of max heart rate. And let's say that for you, that's 130 to 140 and your heart rate happens to be 145. Like, is that a big deal? Absolutely not. I don't want to gatekeep cardio like this. I do not want people stressing over this. Get out, get moving. If you see that it's a zone two day, maybe don't crush it. Maybe go out for 45 to 90 minutes and do something that's a little bit more challenging than just a stroll in the park, but you shouldn't be redlining. That's what I want you to think here. I'm very passionate about this stuff right now, about cardio, about getting the average person to start doing some cardio. And I do not want this sort of like very heightened level of specificity be a roadblock, a hurdle, a stress point. And so you said, you know, rather than just focusing on being active and going for a run, bike ride, and not worrying about what zone I'm in, the less you do, the less this matters. And so if you're training, you know, three to five total workouts a week, then I'm not too worried about it. But if you catch yourself like lifting 4 days a week, running 3 or 4 days a week, yeah, now I might just say, hey, like if it's a zone 2 day, make it a zone 2 day. Make it not too difficult because you're doing a lot. And if you overshoot a little bit, multiplied by a lot of workouts, it might add up in more fatigue than you are assuming that you have. Next question, nothing to do with fitness, and maybe you can answer this on Insta. Curious how you put together the food you make for Gunner and Callie. Do you ever give them treats or supplements? I'm about to be a dog parent, and I really admire how you take care of your dogs. I'm going to use very good dog training too. So I'll tell you right now, my second passion in life is dog training. Like if I wasn't a human trainer, I'd be a dog trainer. And that's only my experience working with my friend Steven. Very good dog training. If you need dog training, he works with people virtually. He works with people locally in Bergen County, New Jersey. But we work together virtually and in person, and it was great. So I will say, for backstory, I prepare all of Gunner and Callie's food. They eat 100% raw food. Like, it's funny because the way I will talk about their diet, there are parallels to how we think about human dieting, and it is just not the same. I want to start by saying dogs have no like non-biological drives to eat. They have no societal drives to eat, environmental drives to eat. They are just eating for overall health. They're not like, they don't have to worry about going over to a friend's house and enjoying super yummy cultural food, or, you know, they just should be, in my opinion, because there are no real non-biological drives to eat, just be eating their kind of normal evolutionary diet or as close to that as possible. And that is eating, let's say, a whole raw food diet. I would not embark on this process alone personally. I would work with a professional. You said you're going to use my friend Steven. His Instagram is at Very Good Dog Training. And that's who I used. And so Steven, I believe, unless he's updated things, uses what's called the BARF guidelines. I know that's a funny name, but a BARF guidelines, which is basically follows a certain macronutrient split, a certain micronutrient split, and a certain emphasis on organs and bones and all of the things that dogs would normally have in their evolutionary diet. So we use the BARF guidelines. I use a company called mypetcarnivore.com, and they make fantastic products. They even make some all-together products that have muscle meat, organs, bones, all of the things that would traditionally be in a whole animal in the proportions that you would want to give it to your animal potentially. And so we use those all-in-one products a lot. They make just fantastic. I just really, really love their company. They ship nationwide. It's awesome. How expensive is it? It depends on the size of your dog. Gunner and Callie are together like 40 pounds, let's say 45 pounds all in. I think Callie's like 16, 17. Gunner's like 25, 26. And it probably costs me, let's say five of those a week at, maybe 5 pounds, 25 pounds a week, $25 a week, but somewhere between 100 and 200 bucks a month to feed them. And that might sound like a lot, but I don't know. I'm not shaming, by the way. Like people are like, oh, I feed my dog kibble. Like, it's great. This is about what I do. This is not a shaming thing. You guys do what you want to do. It's not my business. To me, that feels very much worth it for them to have just the best, longest, healthiest life possible. And it doesn't need to be that complicated. Now, I know my friend Steven feeds all of his dogs raw, and all together he has like, I don't know, 200 pounds of dog. You know what I mean? I have 40 pounds of dog. So I'm not sure how my strategy would change. Would I have much larger dogs? There's also another company called We Feed Raw, which will mail you like individual packets of a whole raw food diet. So they've like blended, you know, blended air quotes, blended all of the things that you would want. They even put like a multivitamin in there. I think they even put like a probiotic, but it's muscle meat and bones and all of the things that you would want your dog to have. They do that more in like an individual packet, which is really nice. I'll order from them if we're going to travel for a long period of time. If we're going to travel for a couple of weeks. If we're going back up to New Jersey, I might put an order in just because it's nice and clean and simple. And they give you these individual frozen packs. Do I ever give them treats? I'll finish this question. We spent too long on this already. Do I ever give them treats? Yeah, they get a raw chicken foot as a treat every day. It's really, really good for their teeth, really good for just like dental health. And they absolutely love it. And if you've never given your dog a raw chicken foot, it is the most ASMR thing. If I'm telling you, I've thought about doing this, just putting like this microphone or whatever next to them while they have it. It's the most ASMR thing you've ever heard. All right, cool. Moving on. Next question. Does it matter if I get 8,000 to 10,000 steps throughout the day versus getting most of them during one long walk or run? It mostly doesn't matter. It almost entirely doesn't matter. And if you are somebody that's like, I know the person asking this is saying this because for them, it's easier, logistically more practical to get the bulk of their steps in a single bout of exercise, like going out for a 30 minute, 40 minute, 60 minute walk or run, because maybe they work a desk job. If that is you, that's awesome. Like the person asking this 99 out of 100 times is feeling some level of guilt that that's how they have to do it. And they hear a lot of people about getting your steps throughout the day. And by the way, I'll make a case for that, but you don't need to feel guilty if that's you. If you need to get the bulk of your steps, the bulk of your movement in a consolidated period, that's awesome. I think there are some tangential indirect benefits of getting steps throughout the day. I think some of that is digestion. I think going for a walk after you eat can be really good for digestion. It's good for glycemic control and it lowers the blood sugar response. I'm not really worried about that stuff, but it does help with digestion is more what I'm concerned with. I always feel really great when I do this. Jenna and I try and finish dinner and within like the next 30 minutes, go for our walk with the dogs. I always feel like if we have a large meal, I always feel way better going out for a walk afterwards. I think getting steps throughout the day is another good way of getting outside during the day. So for mental health, I also find myself way more productive when I get up and move throughout the day. There might even be some research on there being a slight difference in this in terms of overall movement. If you get the steps throughout the day, I don't want to lean into that too much because I think it doesn't matter that much. I think more from the digestive health, maybe from a mental health perspective, from a cognitive health, getting up and moving throughout the day. You know, I don't really enjoy sitting for longer than an hour and a half at a time. I'll even just walk around and do errands, or I'll just walk around errands, do like chores around the house, or I'll just do a quick lap with the dogs. For me, getting that movement throughout the day is good for my mental health, just from breaking up my day. Also sometimes forces me to get outside. So I'd look at those benefits mostly like tangentially, maybe cognitive health wise, quality of life wise, you know, maybe productivity wise, like, but as far as like overall health, I don't think there's going to be a big difference. And if this is how you have to do it, because it's just your lifestyle, awesome. If you have the freedom to get up and move throughout the day a little bit though, I'd probably nudge you to do that. Next question, at what body fat percentage might somebody need to utilize a bulk to gain muscle? So where I think you're coming at this question from is the fact that the leaner you are, the less muscle you can gain at maintenance. Like if you're really, 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 really lean, that puts you in a worse position to do body recomposition. Not that you can't do it, but a less good position to do that. But you use the word need, and I don't think there is a need. I think you can be pretty damn lean as far as lifestyle is concerned, you know, in the 8 to 12% for men, in the 16 to 22% for women, really lean, and still body recomp, and still build muscle at maintenance. So I don't think there's ever like this, like, you're saying the word need, so I'm going to be very technical and say I don't think there's ever a case where you need to do that. practically speaking, I don't even think that body fat percentage is necessarily the thing I think about most. It's not like I'm like, well, you're too lean, you really need to bulk. For me, it's how close to your genetic potential you are, which is just like a proxy for training age. If you've been doing this for 10 years and you're really muscular, that to me is more of the rationale for potentially needing to bulk, practically speaking, because you have already gained so much muscle, you're already so close to your genetic potential that building even more muscle might, in a practical sense, require a calorie surplus. So I'm not so worried about somebody's leanness. I'm more concerned with somebody's muscularity. If you're really muscular and you've been lifting for 10 years, I think that you shouldn't expect much muscle growth without being in a surplus. I'm not sure. I guess leanness would be the second thing I'd care about, but it would be in a much smaller magnitude. I'm not getting through all these. Jesus Christ, way more than I thought. All right, we got 7 minutes. How is your week going? It's going well. I had a good time at the N1 conference. I'm going to try and get my friend Brian Borstein on the podcast to just talk about some of our take-homes, but the week's going well so far. Nice. Oh my God, next question. What are your favorite takeaways from the N1 hypertrophy camp? Any methods that you will incorporate into future programming? I'm going to do a whole podcast on this, so I'll just touch on one thing that I really liked from the weekend. So for context, I went to the N1 hypertrophy camp. It's a 2-day in-person practical, in-person seminar in Colorado at the N1 headquarters. Highly recommend that you go. If you're a hypertrophy nerd, just do the N1 biomechanics course first so you can get more out of it. You don't have to waste time wondering like what a pull around is, or what the short position of the pec is, and you can actually focus on the hypertrophy aspect of the seminar. I will say that we did 3 different experiments. We did an experiment on partial length and partial reps. We did an experiment on rest periods, and we did another experiment on supersets. And all 3 of them went exactly how I would have hypothesized. So when we were going into the experiment, I won't even tell you what they are. I'm not sure if that's my place to explain exactly what we did. I feel like you should go. Maybe Brian and I will dive into it in more details. But we did 3 experiments. And if you had asked me before the experiment started what I thought was going to happen, that is, in fact, what ended up happening. However, it was still super important to actually freaking do it myself. It was very powerful to see it play out. It is one thing to conceptualize kind of, you know, one of the experiments we did was, does resting 2 minutes versus 3 minutes matter when we're doing something like a bicep curl or tricep extension? You might hypothesize that you'd perform better with 3 minutes. You might also hypothesize that you perform just as well after 2 minutes because 2 minutes is enough. And I'll just tell you that is what I hypothesized, that I probably would do just fine with 2 minutes rest between tricep extensions, because for me, that would be a full enough rest to get near optimal performance. And that is what happened. But actually tracking every rep and tracking the rest times and seeing the data really reinforced some things for me, and really not challenged my beliefs, but it reinforced some of those beliefs and empowered me to make some decisions about rest periods that I think are just really helpful in terms of, you know, having more tools in the toolkit, but just basically understanding things to a greater degree so you can make decisions more confidently. So in the true kind of namesake of N1, doing those experiments myself and seeing the data of the whole class and other participants over the last couple seminars was really powerful and was actually really awesome. So that was like, even if the experiments kind of went how you'd conceptualize, it was really powerful to see it play out in person. We got 2 more. Let me just do one little thing here. Maybe my editor will edit this out, but maybe not. All right, next question. Kaz Glute Bridges. It's funny, another N1 sort of reference here. Kaz Glute Bridges. I used to feel them a lot in my glutes, but when I increased weight, I don't feel them so much. Does that mean I need to drop back down in weight? I was at the top of the rep range with previous weight. I will say that as the weights get heavier and heavier and heavier, mind-muscle connection will probably go down. There's probably an inverse correlation here between how hard you're training, how heavy you're lifting, and mind-muscle connection. And if your technique, I'll say this, if your technique is perfect with this new heavier weight, then I don't want you to go back down. We don't chase sensation. We chase progression without the sake of technique. And so if you went up in weight by 10, 20 pounds and your technique is exactly the same, but now you're just training a little bit harder because you have heavier weight and you're kind of inching towards finding out what you're capable of on this movement, I don't want you to change anything. We don't chase sensation. But I will tell you on the glute bridge, it's really easy to add a little bit of weight and think that you are doing the exercise exactly the same. But if you really scrutinize your form video, you'll find that you're not getting all the way up to the top and locking out the hips like you were when you used heavier weight. And it's really subtle. I get, like, if you are hip thrusting or glute bridging 100 pounds and I put 130 pounds, that's a 30% jump. That's a huge jump. I bet you, you can do it. I bet you anybody who's hip thrusting 200 pounds right now, if I put 250 on the bar, you can do it. And it might actually feel or look like you're doing it the same, but if you watch a form video from the side, you might be like, you know what? I'm not getting all the way up to that lockout. Because the glute bridge is significantly harder as you approach lockout, that's gonna be the portion of the range of motion that you start to lose. You're not gonna get all the way up to that full lockout where the glutes are fully contracted, where you might get that sensation, you know, where you were getting it when it was lighter, when you were getting all the way up to the top to the full lockout. So as you're increasing weight, I'm not worried about sensation. If your technique is staying the same and is staying kind of optimal where we want to get all the way up to the top, lock out the hips, squeeze the glutes. But I am skeptical because I do see that all the time where people like add weight, add weight, add weight. And there's these kind of subtle, almost unnoticeable sacrificing of that top range of motion that they don't necessarily feel until like 40 pounds later. They're like, yeah, I don't really feel it anymore. It's like, yeah, because you're missing out on that top locked out position. So I would make sure to give that some thought. But if your technique is really good, then I would not chase a sensation. Oh shit. Not a question, but people need to stop asking who your crush is. What are we, 10? Oh shit. That's funny. There's a lot of them in here, which is hysterical. Like literally having a baby in like fucking 3 weeks. Next question. Is it weird to ask a stranger to spot me in the gym? It's not weird. This is a part of gym culture it depends on the gym, where like is pretty normal. And obviously it's a little confounded by the fact that I do this for a living and I feel very competent spotting somebody. And I actually feel pretty competent or confident asking a random person to spot me. What I would do though, is just make sure that that stranger is capable of spotting you. I'm not trying to be a dick, but if you're like bench pressing 100-pound dumbbells, like try and pick somebody who you think can actually help you move those 100-pound dumbbells should you need help. That's my advice. I don't think it's weird. I think it's normal. I think the person you ask will be very happy to help. Almost all the time. I can't imagine or have not experienced a time where that wasn't the case. So totally normal. Next question. I love your podcast. I'm also a coach. I've been doing online coaching for 2 years and in person for 7. That's awesome, by the way. I find it hard to grow my business. Any tips that are not posting on social media? What worked for you? Yeah, social media is obviously a big one. But at the end of the day, it's still going to come down to you doing a really good job with your clients, getting them good results that they are proud of, and telling people around them about how great you are. There is a word of mouth, even in the online space, that is incredibly powerful. I don't know if you're talking about in person or online, but in person, it's entirely word of mouth. I mean, I built my entire business of like north of like 60, 70 in-person clients just with word of mouth. And so that is to say, okay, if it's in person, it's definitely word of mouth. And I just want to reinforce something that mentors of mine have always reinforced, and that there is nothing that will substitute you doing a really good job for your clients. Like, do good work. Social media is its own game. And yeah, we can go down the social media route in terms of growing your business, but you need to be doing a good job with your clients. They need to be getting results, whether that's physical results or a combination of physical and emotional results, confidence results, changing their life in some way. That is your business card, you know? Like, that's what, it's not like, it's not just like, oh, here's a before and after. It's like changing how people think of you, what people say about you, how you make them feel about themselves so that they talk about you in a way that changed their life. you need to focus on doing a good job. I know that you're, you know, some people are rolling their eyes at like, duh, do a good job, like sick advice, Jordan. But I think a lot of people get caught up in social media and they don't look at how they are servicing their clients. How are you checking in with them? Is it intimate? Does it feel disconnected? Are you just doing email? Are you doing Zooms? How often do they get to hear from you? Do they have your phone number? I'm not saying everyone needs to do all of that, but are you actually like doing right by your client? Are they actually getting a service that they're going to talk highly of? Are they going to talk highly of you? Are you available? Are you responsive? Are you empathetic? Are you kind of a good balance of being direct, but being compassionate? I mean, those are the things I would work on. Social media is tough right now. Of course, there's not a lot of organic growth. I don't want to poo-poo it, but like social media is its own bag of bones right now, which is not even a phrase. But yeah, man, I would really look at your systems, your relationship with your client, the product you're selling, the services you're selling, the communication that you're selling, and I would try and optimize that. All right, last question. I love how committed you are to being a dad. I will say I'm not a dad yet, but I am feeling very committed to being a dad so far. The fact that you took it upon yourself to learn stuff so Jenna didn't need to do it all is amazing. You seem like such a good husband and soon to be dad. That's super nice of you. I will say for people who are in my position, who have a wife that is pregnant and maybe even, you know, like Jenna is pregnant and she works full time. And yeah, I just felt like it was all on her. She was having, you know, pregnancy symptoms and crazy implantation cramping in the beginning and then nausea. And I was just sitting there not doing anything. And so I took some pelvic floor PT courses. I took some like birthing courses. And then later Jenna and I watched them all together. And I recommend Dr. Aaliyah, her Instagram is at Box Wellness Co. She sells a before birth course. It's a 6-module course. She runs, I think, every quarter. It's awesome. It was fantastic. And I'm so happy that I did that because I was able to just, I just want to contribute in some way to this, you know, like I'm not doing anything like, you know, I'm trying to take care of Jenna and give her less to do and all of that stuff. But, yeah, I just feel like it's easy to get overwhelmed with all the potential things you need to learn about from a birthing process scenario. Like, did we need a doula? Do we need a night nurse? Do we, you know, how do we make sure that should we learn about all of the kind of pain management strategies? Like I really wanted to be, I wanted to help with that just because it felt like Jenna was doing enough. And so whatever, I recommend to all my dudes out there, you know, be a part of it, learn about pelvic floor health, you know, learn about the birthing process, learn about how you can get involved. That's kind of our next step over the next week or two is really learning about how I can be involved in the birthing process. I'm not saying everybody needs to want to do that, but I would like to do that in some way. And so I appreciate that. I have no idea what it's going to be like being a dad. I'm trying. That's all. So, all right, guys, that's the end here. I got a call. Thank you to everybody who asked a question. There are some more that are hanging out here. I might save them for another podcast or I might throw them up on Instagram. So thank you guys for asking. I'll see you in the next one.
Thanks for tuning in to this episode of Where Optimal Meets Practical. If you liked the episode, it would mean the world to me if you posted a screenshot to your social media or left a 5-star review on iTunes. That stuff really helps. If you ever want to get in touch with me, just shoot me a DM on Instagram @JordanLipsFitness. I'm always around to chat. Thanks, guys. Have a good one.